for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. It would be wonderful if we could say we're finally pulling out of the Great Recession. But though there are some positive signs for most Americans, it's still a goal, not a reality. As the federal stimulus programs wind down, we wonder what the chances are that a genuine recovery will take hold this year. Joining me in the studio to talk about the U.S. economy in 2010, John Hilsenrath. He's chief economic correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. During the hour, we're going to hear from five economists around the country on what they see happening and then how their interpretations might influence our own decision-making during the coming year. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And you can join us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to you, John.
Good morning, Diane.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Give us a picture of some of these mixed signals you're seeing out there on the economy.
Well, I think mixed is really the key word. What we're going to discover in the next few weeks, and I mean, it's already baked in, is that the economy did start growing more robustly in the fourth quarter. The numbers are going to be plus 4% or possibly over 5% for fourth quarter growth. So we got a turnaround, and that's a good thing. But the economy faces immense challenges in 2010. You need to have really fast growth at this point to make up all the lost ground, in particular that the job market faced in the last couple of years. We're going to get important numbers on Friday on whether the economy finally produced jobs for the first time in 2 years in December. It looks like that's still – there's still not enough growth to get job growth coming. And then – in the coming year, we have the government pulling back on some very important stimulus programs. The Federal Reserve, has been buying mortgage-backed securities. It will have purchased more than a trillion dollars worth of mortgage-backed securities by the end of March. It's planning to stop doing that. We run the risk that as the Fed pulls away, mortgage rates could start to rise, and that could threaten what looks like some stability in the housing market
right
now.
So no second stimulus on your horizon, at least.
Well, a second stimulus is a challenge right now because the other big problem that we face in the longer run for the economy is immense federal deficits and government debt. I was just in Atlanta this weekend at the annual meeting for the American Economics Association. There was a very important paper that came out there from Ken Rogoff that was talking about the growth prospects for countries that run large federal deficits, fiscal debt. We are in that category now. Our debt is on track to be more than 90% of GDP. And what Ken Rogoff and Carmen Reinhart found was that those countries tend to grow a lot more slowly than countries with little federal debt. So the Obama administration in the coming year is going to have to at least start to articulate an exit strategy for all of the borrowing that the government's been doing. We're probably not ready to start winding that down, but they have to start talking about the exit strategy to convince markets.
John Hilsenrath, he's chief economic correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. And joining us now is Alan Sinai. He's chief global economist and president of Decision Economics. Good morning to you, sir. Thanks for joining
us. Good morning. Nice to be with you.
I gather, despite all the bad news out there, you were quoted in the New York Times yesterday as saying, we're really coming back. What are the bright spots that you see?
We already are in recovery. We've been in recovery since late summer. I think recovery, though, refers to what economists call real GDP. We have no recovery in the jobs market yet, and we won't for quite some time. And that's what most Americans feel, that high unemployment rate and joblessness. What is coming back is consumer spending. It's kind of on the weak side, but it's a lot better than it was. In fact, most of the comeback and the picking up steam is more in the manufacturing side of the U.S. economy, and it's a little more of it was so bad, we've been down so long by so much, that anything better than that is what the comeback is all about. So we're coming into recovery with a lot of help from the government, fiscal stimulus, very, very easy money, a little bit of life support, but recovery, absolutely, we're there. And they don't go away right away. So I don't really agree that we're going to fall back into the abyss later this year or next year. That isn't going to happen. This recovery and then expansion is going to last. Going to last a few years.
What about the fact that the government stimulus money is coming to an end?
Well, it is scheduled to end at the end of this year. The economic effects of the stimulus will linger because of lags. I suspect that Washington will do more. Already we have the House having passed some more stimulus, and I have no doubt that Washington this year will provide more stimulus to take us into 2011-2012 and keep the expansion going. So it's what's going to happen as opposed to what's already on the books and going to expire that makes me think we will continue to have, by that time it'll be called an expansion.
I thank John Hilsenrath, chief economic correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, has a question for you.
Alan, as you pointed out, the recovery that we have seen hasn't created any jobs yet. Where do you think the unemployment rate is going to be, not this year, but 2 or 3 years down the road? How do we come out of this? And can we see the kind of low unemployment rates that we saw in the 90s again anytime in the foreseeable future?
No, we won't. Unless we create some policies that we've never done before in our history.
Like
what? This is a real problem. This is a huge, huge problem. Joblessness is part of the system now, part of the business cycle. Probably the unemployment rate has peaked out now at 10%. But 2 or 3 years from now, I would be surprised if we were under 8.5%.
So, but you said unless the government creates some programs like it's never done before. What do you mean?
You know, the task is, because we've already done a lot of stimulus from the spending side, the outlay side, and we have huge deficits and debt. John had the numbers right. The task is to figure out policies that will grow the economy faster, get joblessness down, but at the same time, get those deficits and debt down as a percent of GDP. We have never, as a nation, on the macroeconomic policy side, had to figure out how to answer that question. That's what I meant. So it will take, I can do it in the test tube of my models in my laboratory. The mad scientist in me can create these kinds of solutions. But can we, even if we could get it right in the test tube, can we get it right in the political arena of Washington?
John Hilsenrath.
So, Alan, it seems to me, you were talking about fiscal stimulus before. It seems to me that any kind of stimulus that the government does in 2010 is going to have the word jobs in it, that it's going to be what's constructed in 2010 is going to be different than what we got last year, and that it's going to be very much focused on at least presenting to the public the idea that this is going to directly create more jobs than the last package of stimulus did. What kind of programs do you see coming out of that?
We've seen a hint of that in terms of income support, more transfers to state and local government. This is the House Main Street Jobs Act of 2010 and jobs tax credits. I don't think that will do it. Our jobs problem and structural and cyclical unemployment problems in the past have been most helped by strong economic growth and the policies that would produce that. The conventional ones will cost money, and so Washington will be hard-pressed to do it. That leaves us with sticky high unemployment and a tough road to go in getting jobs down, and that in turn is a big political issue and societal issue for this country.
So, finally, what is your most optimistic scenario?
The most optimistic scenario would be, and we're getting a taste of that, upside surprises on the economic data, where we do better than conventionally thought, even our kind of what we call our baseline forecast. That is not unusual in the beginning stages of an upturn. I suspect we'll probably do better than we think. But that won't be good, and it won't be good enough to get that unemployment rate down enough to be satisfactory. We're going to have to come back to the well with monetary and fiscal policy and figure out how, in this new world that we are in, by the way, we're losing ground against the rest of the world every day, how we get our unemployment rate to acceptable levels.
You
That's
know,
really going to be tough.
You seem to be suggesting that we're going to have to live with a new reality of a higher unemployment rate than we've seen in past decades.
Yes, we're going to have to live with that in a slower growth rate and, relatively speaking, a declining standard of living. I'm sad to report that. That's my view. I think that our country has always been smart enough to figure out how to do better than that. I have great confidence that we will, but at the moment I don't see the kinds of things happening that can make me say other than we better learn to live with a high unemployment rate, less consumer spending on average, and an eroding standard of living. Not a bad standard of living, but an eroding standard of living.
Alan Sinai, he's chief global economist and president of Decision Economics. Thanks so much for joining us, Alan.
Thank you.
And short break. We'll be right back. And you've just heard the thoughts of Alan Sinai. He's chief global economist and president of Decision Economics. He said yesterday in the New York Times, we're really coming back. Joining us now is Paul Krugman. He's professor of economics at Princeton University and op-ed columnist for the New York Times. Good morning to you, Paul. It's good to talk with you.
Good to be back on.
You've written that you worry both the Fed and Congress are not going to realize before it's too late that the job of fighting the slump is not finished. What do you feel needs to be done, first of all?
We should be doing what we've been doing, but quite a lot more of it. We should be using federal deficits are a good thing right now. Not, they have to be cured, but not now. We should be spending more to create jobs. The Fed should be doing more to support financial markets. Basic fact is people are congratulating themselves on a recovery that is at best hypothetical right now, while we still have 10% of the workforce unemployed and very little sign that we're going to get to anything you might call full employment for quite a few years to come. So we need a lot of aggressive action to try and create jobs, which is unfortunately not happening.
So how would you respond to Alan Sinai's point that we're really coming back?
Well, we have some good numbers. But their number, first of all, good numbers that don't turn out to have much long-run significance are typical when you're having a prolonged slump. So just in our own recent history, at least the initial report in early 2002 was a spectacular growth in the first quarter, 5.8%. Now, first of all, that was partly bad data. It got revised down quite a lot later. But mainly, that was a one-time thing. Companies had been slashing production to get rid of excess inventory. When they'd done that, they bumped production back up again, and that gave you one quarter of good growth, but that was that. And that's pretty much what looks like what's happening right now. There's very little sign that the underlying demand is growing. The example that really gets me is back in 1996. Japan had a really, really good quarter, 12% growth initially reported, though that too got revised down, and it turned out to signify nothing. Japan was still pretty much in the early stages of going through the prolonged slump that they're still in today. So, you know, people are looking at a few numbers which don't tell you much about where we're going and saying, oh, problem solved.
John Hilsenrath at the Wall Street Journal is with me. He has a question for you.
Professor Krugman, Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff had a paper at the AEA meetings this weekend arguing that countries with a lot of federal debt as a percent of GDP, 90% or more, suffer from long-run deficits in growth. When and how does the federal government deal with the fact that we're going to have debt in excess of 100% of GDP before very long?
Well, first of all, it's not clear that it's going to go above 100%. It's not clear that that's that's actually in the cards, but it could be. Now, I would say that there's somewhat, you know, their sample mixes countries that are advanced, less advanced. Advanced countries tend to have a lot more debt tolerance, even countries that have relatively weak governments. I always point to Belgium and Italy in the 90s, both of which went above 100% of GDP without severe consequences. That said, you really do want to say, yes, we need a strategy for controlling debts in the long run. Is skimping on support for the economy now that strategy? And the answer, if you even just do the arithmetic, is that it's really foolish. I mean, we're talking about something like $9 trillion of debt accumulation over the next decade. Of that, $700 billion can be attributed to the stimulus. And the fact of the matter is, if you did less stimulus, you wouldn't actually save dollar for dollar. You'd have a weaker economy, lower tax revenues, probably lower long-run growth because there'll be less investment. There's really not much saving in making the economy suffer more right now. So, yes, I mean, I'm worried about the deficit. I'm really worried about the long run. But to use that as an argument for not doing something about 10% unemployment is a really bad choice.
So if neither a housing boom or a consumer spending spree is in the cards for right now, what do you see as the keys to coming back?
Well, if we ask, consumers really can't do a lot of spending, certainly shouldn't. They were doing very low saving before the crisis. They've had an $11 trillion hit due to falling housing prices and a somewhat weaker stock market. Housing, you know, the landscape is strewn with housing developments that may never be occupied. What we would really like to see is business investment. That would help a lot. But it's hard to get businesses to invest when there's a weak economy and they have more capacity than they know what to do with right now. So for the time being, we are really going to be relying on government support to keep the economy afloat. Then you have to look for policies that can help create reasons for businesses to invest. I actually think climate change policy could be a driver of recovery. But it is hard. We don't have a lot of role models for how you recover from this kind of crisis.
John Hilsenrath.
Well, I mean, the other piece of the picture that you didn't mention is on exports. You've been writing a lot about China. How much friction do you see growing between the U.S. and China in the years ahead as a result of its what you describe as mercantilist policies of fixing a low exchange rate?
Well, I think this is there will probably be a lot of friction. There should be. mean, what you have right now is that China is pursuing it's a mercantilist policy by any reasonable standard of the imagination. They're basically seeking to export and not import. They're keeping their currency artificially weak, accumulating vast quantities of foreign exchange reserves in the process. And what that does do under the kind of situation we're in right now is that remember Ross Perot and his great sucking sound? That never happened with Mexico, but it is happening with China right now. China is quite literally sucking demand away from the rest of the world at a time when the world's basic economic problem is that it's not able to create enough demand.
Professor Krugman, I want to take one caller while you're on. Let's go to Marcus in Orlando, Florida. Good morning.
Hi, Diane. Thank you for having me.
Surely.
I have a question about, I suppose, financial transactions tax. A few years back in Brazil, the federal government instituted a 0.25% tax on every financial transaction. In their case, it was everything from checking deposits to God knows what. And I have never heard of that kind of initiative here, but it sort of makes sense to me since the financial market or the financial institutions are basically a pivot point on this whole crisis to at some point use a financial transactions tax of, let's say, 0.1% to help rebuild what was lost with this crisis.
All right. Professor Krugman.
Yeah, I am in favor of a small financial transactions tax. It's a little bit tricky administratively, but I'm told not as hard as you might think to actually enforce it. And the argument against it has always been, well, you know, there's all of these high-speed transactions in the financial markets that are really doing us a lot of good, and you would deter them. But at this point, we have to say actually what those high-speed financial transactions seem to have done is mostly set us up for catastrophe. It would be a tax that would mean almost nothing for any kind of long-term investment, but would really deter the kind of reliance on very short-term financing, these wheeling and dealing, essentially, that led to the crisis. So, sure, I don't think it's a silver bullet. It doesn't solve our problems, but it would be a piece of the solution.
All right, John.
But, I mean, it seems to me one of the problems with a tax like this is that investors are very good at finding ways around taxes, and you would run the risk that you would be driving more of the financial sector offshore, deeper into the shadow banking system, into low-tax havens, hedge funds moving outside of the U.S. So, you know, I wonder if this might actually exacerbate a problem and not fix it.
My understanding, and this is we're going to get too deep into the weeds here,
yeah,
is that people, the kinds of transactions this would actually hit are only possible because you have extremely centralized trading that makes trading costs very low. And there's not a whole lot of places you can do that. This is not something you can move to Mauritius, right? This is something where it's really pretty much New York and London. And I think we can get an agreement with Britain. You know, it's not like we're talking about the whole world. We're talking about a handful of major financial centers. So,
right.
Yeah, it has to be globalized.
And one final question for you. What are you saying to consumers, to individuals who've lost their jobs, to consumers who are out there wondering whether to make that big purchase or not?
Well, my answer is don't. I mean, it's from the point of view of society, we would like people to be individually irresponsible, but you can't advise them to do that, right? It certainly would be helpful for the economy right now if people would just forget about their retirement and go out and spend. But given what's happened, my advice, you know, for your own good, is to be cautious, to save, to not, you know, the days when you could count on the rising value of your house and your ever-growing 401k to ensure your retirement are not are behind us. So no, this is a time to be prudent in a good old-fashioned way.
Paul Krugman, he's professor of economics at Princeton University. He's an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
And now on the line with us from St. Louis, Missouri, is Chris Riveras. He's president of Macroeconomic Advisors. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
I gather that your outlook is quite sunny. Tell us what you see ahead and why.
Well, our view is that the recovery is in fact for real and that it is sustainable. We expect the economy overall, as measured by the gross domestic product, to grow next year at a little less than a 4%, or this year at a little less than a 4% rate. That is enough to stabilize the unemployment rate relatively early this year. We're looking for a quarterly average peak in the unemployment rate of 10.2%, with the unemployment rate then beginning to decline and ending the year closer to 9.5% than to 10%. And so that's relatively good news. It does suggest that there would be employment gains coming relatively soon within the first quarter of this year, and that strong growth would continue through 2011, despite the fact that the boost from fiscal stimulus wanes over the early part of this second half of this year, but and then probably turns slightly negative over 2011. And I think it's important to recognize that while the economy is showing signs of reviving and things in terms of improvement, yes, we can point to improvements, we can point to strong positive growth, but we're starting so far down in a deep hole that the feeling that the average person on the street has about the strength or the well-being of the economy is very different, with the unemployment rate staying well above 8% over the entire next couple of years. The labor market's going to feel very, very weak, and we're not going to see the sense of well-being among people sort of matching the numbers that we see on growth that we as policymakers or economists can celebrate and say, yeah, this is a real recovery.
So that even though you see many businesses poised for profitability, you're not seeing a lot of job growth to go along with that.
No. And, you know, there's a silver lining here and a possibility of a really nice positive surprise. During the recession, businesses were very quick to cut payrolls. And, in fact, as we look at this and we see what happened to how strong productivity was, which is the flip side of those big job cuts, we were a little surprised at just how aggressive the job shedding was during the recession. As we come out of it, and on the one hand, that positions, as you say, firms to have great leverage as their demand that they face picks up to show big jumps in profit in the early stages of the recovery, it also means they may find themselves a little short-handed and maybe quicker to hire than we might otherwise expect. And
John,
so this jobless recovery notion that we keep hearing about, we don't expect it because we think overall demand will be strong enough, and we might get a little extra boost because firms were more aggressive during the recession and cutting payrolls.
John Hilsenrath of the Wall Street Journal has a question.
Right. So Chris, your firm Macro Advisors teams up with ADP, the payroll processing firm, to do these important monthly surveys that check job growth in real time before the government comes out with its own reports. Excuse me. Tell us what's happening. Your numbers were out just this morning, so you have a really fresh point of view. What is happening, or what happened in December? What is happening right now with the job market? And you know, how robust do you see growth, not in the future, but right now at this moment?
Right. Well, as the number was reported this morning, job losses were, and this is data reported for December, 84,000 continuing losses, and this was the best report that we've had in a couple of years, and it points to a continuing gradual improvement. One of the benefits of the ADP National Employment Report that we put together is that it does give us information across firms by size, and in this case, we saw basically relatively equal job losses across small, medium, and large-sized firms, small being fewer than 50 employees, medium 50 to 500, and large over 500. The goods-producing sector continues to be very weak. We had nearly 100,000 job losses in goods-producing, but an actual upturn in service-producing jobs of 12,000 in December, according to the ADP National Employment Report. It's on track, I would say, to turn to positive employment early this year. And again, there's a lot of noise in these numbers. It could happen in January. It might wait until March. But I think the good news is that an upturn in employment is probably just around the corner. We won't really see employment strong enough to have the unemployment rate on a downward trend probably until sometime well into the second quarter.
Christopher Ferris, he's president of Macroeconomic Advisors. He joined us from St. Louis, Missouri. Thank you so much. Good to talk with you.
Good to be here. Thanks.
And we'll take just a short break. When we come back, we'll talk to a couple of other people and take your calls. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. By the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By Jeffrey Kenner, in appreciation of NPR's international coverage and its foreign correspondents. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
A surgeon and renowned medical writer looks at how a simple checklist can save lives. He says it can help doctors and nurses deal with increasingly complex technology and reduce human error. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. Joining us now from his office in Washington, D.C. is Douglas Holtz-Aiken. He was director of the Congressional Budget Office from 2003 to 2006. He was senior domestic policy advisor to the McCain campaign. Good morning, Doug. Good to have you.
Happy New Year, Diane.
Happy New Year. I gather you're in the camp of those who say it's going to be a very long and slow recovery. Tell us why you believe that and what it's going to take to get people back to work.
I think that the two main reasons why I expect us to have a continual but fairly prolonged and slow recovery is the historical precedents that economies coming out of large financial crises take 5 years to fully recover from their after effects. And the fact that when we look at the U.S. economy, the driving force for well over a decade has been U.S. households who have borrowed enormous amounts of money against their homes and otherwise to spend. And they've taken enormous hits to their portfolios. Their houses are worth less. Their retirement savings are worth less. And there's no reason for them to go out and spend money hand over fist. So we've got some real losses that can't be replaced in the financial sector and in the housing sector. And as that gets rebuilt, the economy will improve. But it's going to take time.
What steps do you think the government should be taking at this point?
Well, I think the key steps are to do the kinds of things that have been done on the social safety net, because unemployment is likely to be high for a prolonged period. I also think it's important to recognize that with the household sector not being very strong and with the government genuinely needing to tighten its belt, the large deficits that we face are a threat to the economic recovery. You're going to have to look to the business community and to our export community as sources of growth, and every effort should be made to put in place policies that make their lives easier.
Here's an email from Susan in Cary, North Carolina. She says the U.S. is doing very little investing in new technologies. India is putting a great deal, 10 times more of their money, into research and development. Do you agree with the information? And if so, how can we possibly improve our economy if we don't invest in the future? Doug?
I think that's an imperative. It's exactly right. One of the reasons we need to close the federal budget deficit, one of the reasons we want households to actually save more, is that's the pool of funds that would be available to plow into new technologies. We should also take better care of our incentives for innovation. We have a research and development tax credit that is not very well designed and which gets renewed on an annual basis in a pretty craven political fashion. We should put in place permanent innovation policies that reward the kinds of things that are the markets of the future.
Let's take a caller in St. Louis, Missouri. Dimitri, you're on the air.
Welcome back, Diane.
Thank you.
It's true that man never learns anything from history. I lived during the Depression and through the presidency of Franklin Roosevelt, and he faced the deepest depression this country has ever endured. And what he did was he closed the banks. He didn't direct all of his funds to Wall Street and the bankers, and he created programs for average American people. An example is the WPA, and they hired thousands of people, and when they did, then those people became consumers, and the consumers brought the economy around. And this government has done exactly the opposite, and if it keeps doing the same thing, it's going to get the same results.
What about the FDR example, Doug?
Well, we know that the policies that were put in place during the Great Depression were a mixed blessing. In some cases, they actually made the Depression worse. We know the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, the Federal Reserve's policies have been well documented as moving us in the wrong direction. I think the good news in this episode is that we haven't done those kinds of terribly destructive things. At the same time, I don't believe the federal stimulus policies have been very efficient. We've spent what will be $1 trillion in the end and not generated much in the way of a real improvement in the economy. We could have done better.
One last question from John Hilsenrath of the Wall Street Journal.
Hi, Doug. We've been talking a lot about debts and deficits this morning. Where do you expect the retirement age to be by the year 2020, 2030? It seems to me one of the only ways to resolve this entitlement problem is to move that up. And how high does it need to go to put a dent in the entitlement deficit that we're going to be facing then?
Well, I think that you cannot solve the entitlement problem with the retirement age alone. It's just too big for that. It won't even solve Social Security, but it's one piece of what would be a sensible set of solutions. I think if you indexed it for expected longevity, by 2020 you'd be looking at age 72.
72. Sounds right to me. Douglas Holtz-Aiken, he was director of the Congressional Budget Office from 2003 to 2006. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And now, by phone from Minneapolis, James Paulson. He's chief investment strategist for Wells Capital Investment. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Dan.
You've written recently that you think the new year should bring a return to economic normality. Is that an optimistic view, or do you believe that that's what's going to happen?
Well, I think the key word there is return, a start, if you will, towards that stepping. I mean, if you look, what we've done in 2009 is we've returned to profitability all four quarters, I think, will have produced positive profit growth and pretty rapid profit growth at that. As we get into the new year, I think not only are we going to have the return of profitability, but in part because of that, we now are going to start job creation. Maybe we'll find out this Friday that we started creating jobs again in this country. We've already also had 5-6 months now in a row of rising home prices that we didn't have before. We certainly have reinstated some sense of normality in the financial markets, be it the stock market or many parts of the bond market. And I think we're starting the process of starting to rebuild confidence as well. And I do think when you put all those things together, you've kind of reestablished a self-sustaining economic cycle again, where profits produce jobs, jobs produce income, income begets spending, and spending produces profits.
So for you, the idea of a double-dip recession is not part of your thinking.
I think there's a very low probability on that, Diane. I just think we've got the lagged impact of all this policy stimulus that is still going to come through and work its way through Main Street yet. Some of this is going to be new stimulus with Obama's 787 that will come in 2010. But in addition to that, we've already started to turn the corner. You can start to see animal spirits re-enter the picture here. You certainly see it in the investment markets where people are getting back into junk bonds or back into the stock market. You're starting to see it in the real world where companies are starting to make acquisitions again or IPOs. And I think that without any real big change in interest rates or other policy variables, I think the momentum is clearly in the upward direction.
John Hilsenrath, the Wall Street Journal, has a question.
Hey, yeah, Jim, it's good to catch up with you.
I think you're
putting your fingers on one of the great ironies and potential missing links in this recovery that we haven't talked about yet, which is asset price inflation. This recession, the depth of it was caused largely because we had a huge decline in prices of homes and prices of stocks, and we're seeing that turn around. The Fed engineered that. This is really the linchpin of the government's recovery strategy, is to bring down interest rates and engineer a turnaround in asset prices. It seems to me that one of the drivers of a recovery might be one of the things that caused us, that pushed us into this in the first place, which is that asset prices rose a lot. What do you think of that?
I think that's true, John, but I would also say that many of the things that the rhetoric that we hear that we fear of creating another bubble, it's part and parcel of capitalism. It's the way we exit every recession I can think of. We always sort of drop interest rates and increase the money supply and induce more fiscal spending, and as a result, get the stock market back up, if you will. And there's nothing new about what we're doing now than we did, throughout recessions in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. It is true, there is some great truth in the fact that maybe rates stayed too low for too long, particularly as it around the mortgage market in this country that led to a bubble. But I also think that we're doing nothing today that we haven't done to exit past recessions. And indeed, I think it's working in a very similar fashion again. It's rebuilding confidence, and it's starting to pass off to government-induced pushing, a recovery, to now private sector behaviors starting to take over and push the recovery.
Here's an email from Frank in Selma, North Carolina. He says, we never look at the whole picture. If, according to Kevin Phillips, the top richest 10% of the U.S. owns 90% of the stock market, one can see why the stock market is going up for no solid reason and why unemployment is a problem. There is The World is Flat by Tom Friedman. Here at ground level, people are out of work. There are no jobs. The U.S. manufactures almost nothing. Money is made off interest rates between banks and moving money around. When you talk about unemployment, you have to understand there are people who've walked away and given up. The best we can hope for is 60 to 65% of the labor force will work full-time. The rest will be running between part-time jobs. This is not temporary, but a reality for our future. How do you see that, James Paulson?
Well, it is certainly true that there's always been a biased distribution of income and wealth in this country, and it is also true that in the last 25, 30 years, it's gotten worse. And there's no doubt of that. I think too much of that is certainly unhealthy and might well be a contributing factor to the crisis that we've had in sort of rejiggering some of that income distribution. But I also think that you're never going to get Main Street going and Main Street job creation going unless you also get Wall Street going. That's just the way it isn't the way it works today or in recent decades. It's the way it's always worked. And I think that it is, if you want to create job creation in this country again, you need to get Wall Street going and the animal spirits that goes with that. And that will indeed ultimately produce a better Main Street. You know, we had 10.8% unemployment in 1982, and many of the similar themes that I hear in that email you could have said about that era as well. And yet the result was that we eventually did grow again, and we eventually did bring down the unemployment rate over a long number of years and create jobs and wealth and income. And I think we're going to do that again.
All right. Let's take a caller in Indianapolis. Good morning, Thomas. You're on the air.
Hey, Diane. I really think we're at the brink of a change between the old economy and a completely new one. And I think the old one was based on extracting from humans and nature. And I think the new one will be based on sharing resources and cooperating with each other. And I'd like to hear the response to those ideas.
Jim Paulson.
I think there's some merit in that, at least in this country. I think one of the things we're finding out increasingly is the world increasingly opens its political and economic boundaries, which is one of the great things we've done in the last few decades, is we've gotten away from political or economic boundaries, increasingly freeing floating exchange rates and free-flowing trade. And the result of that has been the ability for even more rapid world growth, which, and indeed, we're seeing that with the development of these new emerging world economies that simply didn't exist 15, 20 years ago, that are now a tremendous asset for the world's future. But I agree with the caller in that what comes with that, not only is the chance to grow at a faster rate across the globe, but also the recognition very quickly that we're all mutually dependent on one another, far beyond just economics. And we've become mutually dependent on one another in terms of rationing resources, controlling pollution, and many other issues. And I think that it is true that we're going to focus more not only in the developed world, but throughout the economy, or the global economy, on issues of how we share things for our mutual benefit.
John Hilsenrath.
Well, I would agree with the caller in one respect and disagree in another. I think that the economy is in the midst of historic change in eras. What I see happening, though, is this is a technological change. The advent of the internet and high-speed communications has changed almost every industry that you look at, including mine, the newspaper industry. I don't see the dramatic change being between extracting and sharing. I think it's the changes in how technology is disrupting industries across the globe. And one of the things that's worth noting is that we very often see financial crises happen around periods of technological change. That's what led to the internet bubble. People got their expectations too far in advance of what the industry could produce. And it was also very much at the center of the financial crisis that we've just been through. Very innovative financial products that people didn't understand took over Wall Street.
Last quick comment, Jim Paulson.
I think that one of the things that I think people should focus on is that crisis and capitalism have always gone together, and as far as I'm concerned, they always will. And our quest to eliminate crisis is somewhat folly and almost somewhat dangerous. Crisis provides a great function in capitalism of cleansing the system, of bringing out the stick and setting up the economy so it can have another fabulous period of growth.
And
if we try to reduce that, I think we try to we also reduce the future growth prospects. So I think we should be careful of getting too negative on these crises.
James Paulson, Chief Investment Strategist for Wells Capital Investment, and John Hilsenrath, The Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.